The following program is produced by the Tech Talk Radio Network.
Hey, this is Mike Nelson from Mystery Science Theater and RiffTracks.com, and you're listening to the greatest show on the planet, Tech Talk Radio.
This is Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andy Taylor.
And I'm Justin Lemme. Welcome.
We're the show that talks about computers,
technology,
and the internet. This has been a crazy week. I know just recently we had the anniversary of the earthquake in Japan, which was really bad. And I didn't know that you were there when this happened.
Yeah,
actually, I had no idea you were in Japan when that big earthquake hit.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of a little surprised you didn't know I was there, because, I mean, I'll tell you.
You did a media blitz.
I did a media blitz, actually. I don't know how to put this. I'm kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
No, actually, what happened was, okay, so yeah, it was 2011, March 11th of 2011. My wife and I were vacationing in Japan with her parents and everything. You know, my wife is Japanese.
Right.
So we were there at her parents' house, and it was actually my last day. I was heading back 2 weeks earlier than Misa was. So I'm just like sitting there. It was like 2 p.m. or something like that, and browsing the iPad or Facebook or something like that. And I felt an earthquake start. And initially, you know, living there for so many years, I didn't really do anything. I was just kind of like, yeah, whatever, an earthquake.
It's like being in California, you get used to them, right?
Yeah, you get used to them. And yeah. So I kind of felt it a little bit. I was like, oh, okay, earthquake, no big deal. And my wife was like just about to leave to go to like the store or the bank or something. All of a sudden, just within like 30 seconds or so, it just went boom and it hit really bad. And I was like, oh my God, this is big. This is huge.
Yeah.
You know, so I ran, tried to run, mostly bouncing off the walls as I was kind of walking back and forth, trying to go downstairs to be with Misa and her mom and her grandmother. Her grandmother actually lives on the first floor of the house.
Oh, wow.
And so I went down there, and at that point, everybody was kind of like looking at each other like, what is going on? When you see a Japanese person get scared of an earthquake, you know it's a big deal.
Yeah.
I looked over at Misa, and she's kind of holding on to this flat screen television, like trying to keep it from falling over.
Save the TV!
Yeah, save the TV. And then her mom and grandmother are back inside of like the kitchen in the back of the house. But in order to get out from that area, they would have to walk past all these shelves that had all this glass that was like, you know, she kept like, you know, glasses and china plates and stuff like that inside this cabinet. And they would have to walk past it to get past. And the whole thing was like rattling. So they were kind of scared to walk past it in case the glass broke loose and all the stuff came down. So I'm kind of like looking at Misa, and I'm looking over at her mom and her grandmother. And I'm like, we got to get out of here.
Yeah.
And like, that was our first thought. We got to get out of the house. And so I told Misa, I was like, you know, bleep the TV.
What? How dare you?
I was like, bleep the TV. We need to get the bleep out of here.
Yeah.
And so she came running towards the front door, and her mother came kind of coming towards the front door, but her grandmother was kind of there, and I ran back and kind of like helped her get to the front door.
Yeah.
To get, you know, kind of shield it from
the
whole
thing. Is it still shaking at this point?
Oh my God. It shook for like 5 straight minutes. And it was like,
amazing.
It was unbelievably how strong the shaking was. Part of the reason it shook so much in Tokyo. Now, we were in Tokyo. We were not in Sendai, where the earthquake epicenter was. We were in Tokyo, but North Tokyo. So we were about like 150 miles or so away from this epicenter. But it was so shaking so bad. And the thing that made it even worse is that now homes in Japan are actually built upon a set of like rollers, kind of like a ball bearing system that helps stabilize the house in the event of an earthquake.
Right.
So it protects the house from damage, but what it doesn't do is it doesn't protect from damage in your pants.
Great. Thank you. We needed that. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. You needed that visual because that's what was going on in my head. As we approach the front door, I open the door and I look out. The first thing I see out front is the asphalt is got a big crack in it, and I can literally see the earth moving up and down.
Now, there was footage that was on You were working at Fox in San Diego at the time,
Fox,
right?
Fox 5 San Diego at the time, yes. Now, and I you had, sent him the video.
Is that your video of the ground actually moving up and down? Wow, amazing stuff.
Yeah, and so the ground was moving, and you could see it was moving within inches. Like, I mean, it was variations of inches vertically. That's how much the ground was moving. I mean, it was spectacular to see, but at the same time, it was absolutely horrific. And the only feeling that I could really feel at that moment was a complete sense of helplessness, because there's literally nothing you can do to stop this from happening. You just have to ride it out. So as I saw the ground and what felt like hours that I was looking at this ground, which actually probably only ended up being seconds of me looking at the ground, I then look up and I see like the power lines up above, and the power lines are whipping back and forth like a kite in high winds. And I knew immediately, I was like, this is not safe. This is actually more dangerous to be out here than it would be inside. So I said, no, we're staying inside. So we kind of huddled around each other right in the doorway of her parents' house. And we didn't, like, when I say door, we didn't stand underneath the door frame like they teach you in school. We just did stand kind of in that general area of the door, and we just kind of looked at each other and held hands. I mean, there's just, like Liz said, there's nothing you can do. And after about 5 minutes, it finally seemed to calm down.
Right.
But after that, you know, that's when the aftershocks started kicking in, and the aftershocks were almost just as bad as the original. But the aftershocks would happen every, you know, 10 or 15 minutes. But between the aftershocks, it was just a constant moving. The earth was so disrupted by this earthquake that the earth continuously moved for a good 24 hours. Like, you just could feel, it felt like you're on a cruise ship. Have you ever been on a cruise ship under high seas? It felt like that.
I remember the Landers quake in Palm Springs. It just was constant. You would be on, we'd be on the air, and you would tell, all of a sudden the speakers behind you would start shaking and moving back and forth. Now I'm wondering, you know, in light of this, many of us think, what is going to be emergency preparedness reaction to an emergency like this? How was it, like, technically? Did you have reports immediately?
Oh my God, immediately. Really? Within seconds on the TV, they had, you know, those little overlays. Like, you know, a lot of people that live in America, they have the overlays that appear on their local news for, like, tornado warnings or severe thunderstorms. They had an overlay that showed, like, the island of Japan, and it showed where the earthquake happened, and then it showed, like, tsunami warnings and all that stuff happening. But by the time it all happened, it was too late. We did not know what was happening up in Sendai, you know, where the Fukushima nuclear plant was. We had no idea what was happening. But the thing is the earthquake epicenter, I don't remember exactly how many kilometers off coast it was. It was not far, but the tsunami hit within, like, seconds of the earthquake happening.
Yeah.
Now, they did some research on the whole, what actually happened, and apparently the shelf, the tectonic plate had been pushing up against the other one, and it bent down so far that it got to the point of being like a spring.
Right.
And they said when it finally released, when this earthquake happened, it released and it actually shifted that spring-loaded tectonic plate up about 10 feet. Now, 10 feet doesn't seem like a lot, but when you're talking about thousands of miles or hundreds of miles of a tectonic plate, all of a sudden moving up at the same time at 10 foot, that is what caused that massive tsunami.
That's what we obviously saw. I mean, I remember it was on the TV. We didn't have any idea what was going on. And I remember turning on the television just to turn it on, and every channel was covering it as the water was coming in.
Yeah.
And just horrific. Now, did they have sirens that went off in the city during this?
Again, the moment the earthquake went off up in Sendai and other places. Now, in Tokyo, they didn't, because Tokyo is relatively protected from tsunamis. I mean, the Tokyo Bay is absolutely protected. Now, like, places, you know, on the outskirts of Tokyo, like Chiba, Narita was where the airport is. Those are more along the Pacific coast, coastal region. Those places had alarms, but like Sendai and all that, their alarms hit immediately.
Now, what about cell phones?
But obviously, it wasn't enough to get people out.
It wasn't enough at all.
No.
Now, for cell phone technology in an earthquake where power grids are usually shut down, did you guys lose power?
No, we did not lose power. We actually didn't even lose internet or television.
Really?
I think they did lose cell phone coverage, though, because I think the network just got overloaded.
Right.
And I think that's why we couldn't do cell phones. I believe so. I could be wrong, but I believe we lost cell phone coverage. But I was, we were very fortunate to keep television so we could see what's going on and keep internet, to be honest. They did shut off the gas, though, however, and for good reason.
Yeah, they
shut off the gas to everybody. And so everybody, they didn't have hot water and stuff like that. But the internet was still up, and that's why I was able to go onto Facebook and I was like, hey, everybody, we just had a massive earthquake here. I'm okay. Everybody's okay. Mises okay. And that's when my local television station that I worked for, my boss, who's a friend of mine on Facebook, picked it up and was like, hey, he contacted me. He's like, hey, can you go live with us right now? Because we're, just getting into like the 5 a.m. hour of the morning show. We want to talk to somebody who's there. And I was like, yeah, sure.
Wow.
So I did like a Skype interview with them from Japan. And then not only that, but then all of our other Tribune media stations picked it up and was like, oh my gosh, we want to talk to you too. So all of a sudden I'm doing interviews for like all these other stations.
Right.
And it was just like, it was crazy because first off, I mean, I'm extremely stressed out. I'm extremely tired with all the stuff going on. And there was not a drop of alcohol or cigarettes anywhere in the house. And I at the time I was still smoking and I was like, I really, really want a drink and a smoke right now.
Oh yeah.
But I had nothing to do. So I could not do that.
Wow. Amazing.
And so I was doing interviews for like a good, 3 to 4 hours.
Well, and I think that's even more amazing too, after something like this, because I remember Landers was what, a 7-1 or a 7-2. It took a while to get power restored. So yeah, that's pretty amazing.
This was a 9.0 in Tokyo.
Amazing.
And so it comes down as one, I can't remember, I don't know, fourth or fifth largest earthquake in the world. Actually, might have gotten bumped down now to the sixth because of the recent one in Nepal.
Right.
That happened a couple of years ago. But still, it was one of the largest earthquakes in the world. And honestly, not a lot of people get to say that they've been in and survived a 9.0 earthquake.
Absolutely. And you know what that shaking felt like.
I never want to experience that again.
I can't even imagine seeing the road split and moving up and down. But
it was really weird.
It does say something, though, for technology and that side of it. The human element is strong, but the fact that you're able to Skype with a station in the United States after something like this happens just tells you how small,
well,
really this world is.
Yeah, and it also tells you how good of technology a small country like Japan has. I mean, almost every single home in Japan has the ability to get gigabit fiber.
What? Really?
When I was living in my own house in Japan, I had gigabit fiber from NTT Docomo, and my bill was like $50 a month.
Oh, man.
Here, gigabit fiber is like $120 a month, and the quality is not
that
great.
That's if
you can get it. Like 10% of the households in America can get gigabit fiber. Almost every single house does. But that's because they're so close together and everybody lives in the populated areas, whereas America is so spread out and sprawling, and you got rural areas. That's why they can't get it all out there. But Japan has amazing quality internet.
How is the Wi-Fi there? Do they have public Wi-Fi?
Mm-mm.
Is that something they do?
No, they don't have public Wi-Fi. At least not when I was there last. I mean, they might have upgraded stuff, now, but when I was there, they didn't have that. Wi-Fi was pretty much just same as we have here. You got it in your home, you got it in your coffee shops, stuff like that.
Right. Wow. Amazing. That blows my mind.
There is a fantastic YouTube video, and I'll have to find it. I'll have to find the link, and I will post it on the Tech Talk Radio page and on the website.
All right.
But it is a scientific video of all the earthquakes that happened in Japan during the year of 2011, including the big one and all the aftershocks that happened. When you see this recreation of all the earthquakes happening, it's just a map. It's just a map with little pinpoints of where the earthquakes happened and their strength.
Right.
When you see that, it really just hits home how powerful this earthquake really was.
Do you think technology will ever be able to kind of pre-guess an earthquake? And would they want to let us know? I mean, we have early sirens for tornadoes. With earthquakes, I mean, is it Could it be something that they could eventually develop?
They do actually have that. I mean, they're, you know, with the sensors and stuff, they can sense the changes in tectonic plates and things like that. But I don't think they can actually predict when something like that would happen, where the shelf just completely gave way.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just something that was just, you know, I don't even have any words for it.
Well, one of the things we also wanted to cover today is the fact that for those of us in Arizona, we're looking at temperatures of about 90 to 95 degrees. And in a closed car, those temperatures climb. Now, while you're in Denver, are you still getting snow?
Oh, gosh, no. We have not gotten any precipitation. Today, it hit 75 degrees. This weekend is going to hit 80-some degrees. There has not been any precipitation for 3 to 4 weeks.
Not like the people in New York.
Oh, yeah, no. I'm actually kind of jealous a little bit. I kind of want to get a little bit more snow before the springtime comes.
Well, yeah. Because
I know that if this is going to happen like this, we're going to be in a severe drought, and it's going to be super hot this summer.
Well, and that's what I'm wondering. You know, California obviously has been wanting rain for a long time.
Yeah, you guys begged it for a long time, and you got a they got metric ton of
like,
rain.
Like, okay, I gotcha.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
Got the message loud and clear.
But I want to remind people, and even though the heat is hitting us a little early here in Arizona, even in the areas that are listening to this in Indiana or Palm Springs, or even, you know, if they're listening in Virginia, I'm not sure what the situation is in Virginia. I'm sure they're dealing with some of this bad weather. That weather can affect your technology. And mm-hmm. For us, the heat is a killer to devices. Now, one of the things that one of our listeners asked us last week, Katie, had asked us on these rechargers for your phones and your laptops. She has a tendency to leave them in her car. And, you know, these are the battery ones. You just plug your cell phone in or your tablet, and you can get juice for another charge or two charges.
Basically, what you're doing is you're leaving a battery in your car.
Exactly. And she wants to know, is that a dangerous thing to do?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Because they heat up.
Just a little bit.
How many times have you and this happens to me all the time, is, you know, I get out of my car. I'm out of my car for maybe an hour. And I go to get back in the car, and I go to pick up my phone. Number one, it's super hot. Number two,
yeah, very bad.
It says, you know, it's got that red mark and the temperature on it, and you can't use it. You know, so I mean, those are situations that can happen. And the idea of leaving your tablet, your smartphone, your computer, even in a computer bag, is actually
not a good idea.
Yeah, not good. So if you're going to be doing any traveling with your technology, even a digital camera, anything that has a battery, anything that is powered by electronics, etc., don't leave them in your car.
You know, when I used to live in Tucson, I remember this one time where I was walking by a car. This is actually a very kind of a sad story, actually.
Oh, no.
I remember walking by a car, and I looked in the window, and inside the, this was like in the middle of summer. It was like 103 or 4 degrees, which means it was probably closer to 170 or so inside the car.
Right.
I looked in the window, and I saw the most precious little iPad in this car.
I think you're going to talk about a little dog or something.
And I felt so bad for this iPad. I broke the window of the car.
And saved its life.
I saved its life. I mean, the poor little iPad was like baking inside this car. And I was like, you can't let an iPad bake. I mean, I know I don't like Apple, but I mean, I'm not vicious. I'm not horrendous.
Right.
I mean, come on. I mean, it's an iPad. You got to save it, you know? So I broke the window and I saved the iPad.
I got arrested
for like theft and breaking and entering. I was like, what the hell, guys? I was just going to do something nice.
You're just being a humanitarian.
I know, right?
Yeah, you were doing a good deed.
I was trying to.
People shouldn't leave their... I think maybe we should start a campaign. You know, we could include pets, people, senior citizens, and now electronics.
Yeah, exactly.
If you leave it in a car, we're going to smash your window and take it.
And we're going to take it.
Even if it's cold.
Yeah, if it's cold. You know, just because. Like, I want that new Note 8 there. I'm going to smash that window.
I kind of went through this, and we recently... You took a look at Cobra dash cams.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I remember talking with Chris. Chris was one of the main guys at Cobra.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about it, is the fact that my dash cam basically blew up. I mean, if you look at it, the battery separated from the back of the LCD. You know, we talked about it. And, you know, the stress test they put on these devices is good. But The real smart point is if you have a dash cam, a lot of people have them now, whether they're Cobra or some of the other manufacturers, pull them out of your car when you get out of your car. Just make it a habit. It takes what, maybe an extra 45 seconds to just connect that battery and then pull it out? Because if it's in the sunlight and you've got that Arizona sun bearing down on it.
Oh, yeah, it's the worst.
You can imagine. It was.
Yeah.
And so, you know, now I've still have this camera. He actually said, send it back. I'll get you a new one. I just haven't done it. But
yeah,
it works for about maybe 30 seconds on battery and that's it.
Yeah, I noticed that with the dash cams on the Cobra. Yeah, if I unplug it, the battery itself, mine will last maybe 20 to 30 minutes or so.
It's supposed to be an hour, I think?
I don't know, but I just keep it plugged in.
Yeah. But you don't want to keep it plugged in if you're out of the car and it's hot.
Well, true. During the winter season here, I can keep the both devices, my radar detector and my dash cam plugged in. I have two USB cables going up and it just plugs into the side. But, you know, during the summertime when it gets hot, I can easily just remove the dash cam and the radar detector and just throw them in my glove box, which that's enough right there to protect it. I mean, even if it gets hot in the car, the glove box will still be better for it than it would be if it was just sitting in the window in the bright sunlight.
We had a text as well, and this kind of worked it perfectly. This is actually about a month ago, and I don't think we ever addressed it on the show. If we did, stop me. But when you have electronic devices plugged in your car, because a lot of us charge I get in my car, I have a charging cord, I'll just plug my smartphone right into it. But when you get in your car and you go to start your car, do you unplug those? Does it kind of make sense? Because, you know, you wouldn't want to flip on an outlet while your thing's plugged in. You know, I mean, I'm not an electrical engineer, but it just seems like it makes sense.
Wait, you're saying that you're asking me if I unplug my devices before I power off the car?
Power on the car.
No.
No? It's not going to matter?
No.
It's run by the 12-volt system?
It's low voltage. It's low voltage, dude.
Yeah.
It's not going to matter.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably why I didn't answer him. I wasn't sure. Well, you know, you can send us your questions anytime. If you have a question about some of this stuff, you can text it in as well. Our text number is 520-204-1754. Or you can, you know, even you can make a note on Twitter. We're on Twitter at Tech Talk Radio. Tech Talk Radio.
And at Tech Talk Radio,
at Tech Talk Radio. And of course,
or Facebook, facebook.com/ Tech Talkers, not Tech Talk Radio, Tech Talkers. Yes. That's our Facebook page.
Have you ever had anything taken out by the heat?
Taken out by the heat. I believe I've had a couple things melt from time to time. I don't think anything like electronic or whatever, but I've had a couple things destroyed by the heat. I've
told this story before, but it's just a good reminder with the heat. Mike O'Brien, who, you know, we started Tech Talk Radio back in 20 years ago, celebrating our 20th anniversary this year. Mike was a tech. He would go around and fix computers and do all that stuff. But he's still doing that stuff now. But he had a can of compressed air. And we, us techies, we use those cans quite a bit, believe it or not, when you're, you know, cleaning your computer, etc. And he had left it in a bag with a, not a tablet. They didn't have the tablets back then. And sure enough, that thing exploded and shot right through. I think it was a Palm Pilot. And it just completely shattered the screen on the Palm Pilot.
Not a big loss.
So you're just so nice to tech.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue talking about technology. Some new things announced this week. Maybe some questions that we can answer for you as well. Again, 204-1754 in the area code of 520. You can text that into us. I'm Andy Taylor.
I'm Justin Lemme. We'll be right back.
And now back to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. My name is Justin.
I'm Andy Taylor. Thank you for tuning in. All right, so how many times have we told you, be careful what you connect? I sounded like a dad there, didn't I? How many times have we told you?
How many times do I got to tell you? You never learn, darn kids.
Be careful when you connect. You know, use something to protect your connection. Actually, this is really kind of a funny story because, you know, we've been actually telling you for quite some time. If you find like a floppy disk on the streets, you don't want a floppy. You don't want to
find. No, who would find a floppy disk on the?
I mean, just trying to make a point. You know, you don't have to put strange things into your computer. You don't go home and go, hey, look.
Who's going to have a floppy drive anymore?
Well, somebody might.
No,
somebody might.
Well, then honestly, I wouldn't mind if they put a floppy disk in their computer and it fried it, because it's time to get with the times, man.
All right, so we'll move up from a floppy disk. How about a USB stick?
Okay, yeah, there we go.
Because there was a time not too long ago where people would drop USB sticks on the ground that were
on purpose,
and these basically contained malware, so that you would suddenly infect your computer, and then the bad guys have access to your stuff. Well, we've been saying this for a long time. Just don't do it. And, you know, the curiosity killed the cat. You always want to, you know, see what's on this drive, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I would want to. So is there a way around that? I mean, really? Put it onto a computer you don't care about?
It's
not connected to the web.
Yeah, put it on a computer you don't care about, and then, yeah, you can see what's on it. But, I mean, it is true. There are people that do this on purpose, and there are those USB kill drives that actually are not a storage device. It's actually it's a small capacitor that's inside of it, and when you plug it in, it completes the circuit, and it will fry your computer. It will literally fry your computer.
What we're talking about is a story that was put out by Zach Whitaker at ZDNet, and he just put this out this week, and we saw it, and we thought, wow, you know, we knew that this exists out there, but, you know, somebody's talking about it. It's a company based in, Hong Kong that has this drive. Is there a purpose for it other than really just to disable?
Just to disable, yeah. I mean, it's like a spy gadget in a way, but it's like, I think they were touting it, selling it as a prank device, but it's really not a prank.
If somebody comes over and plugs something into my USB port to blow up my computer and say, hey, what a joke, huh?
Yeah,
they're not going to get a very good reception.
It's just a joke, dude. Chill out, man.
All right, so now the thing is these things are out there in the wild, these USB killed sticks, so you really need to be careful, number one, of this. We'll put a link up to the full article, but it's something you should be aware of. Just don't plug anything into your computer you don't know about, even if it is a 5 1/4 floppy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not going to happen. No.
Actually, if you have one of those, I want one.
Go play some good old Jet Boot Jack from the Commodore 64 era.
Oh, man, the good old days. Mm. Oh, the good old days. All right. So you're warned about that, but again, we'll have a link up there. Also, on another note real quick, check out the blog. Slick posted a blog story there that was also going around about some products that were actually shipped with malware on them.
Yeah, some.
You can read the article again on our blog, blog.tiktokradio.com. Mm-hmm. All right, so we received a question in from listener Lisa, and said that a friend of hers is getting married, and she was looking for a solution that would allow the people at the wedding to go ahead and take photos and upload them. And while some have kind of stayed away from that, it's really been a long tradition for the bride and groom to leave out disposable cameras in the past so everybody could take a picture. Well, on the line with us is social media director for WedPick. It's Christina Child to tell us a little bit about what their company offers, which I think is really a great solution for what Lisa's looking for and her friend that's getting married. Christina, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. And yeah, you're right. We like to think of ourselves as the disposable camera on the table that you saw a long time ago. And, you know, now it's 2017. You absolutely should not be buying disposable cameras to put on your wedding tables.
Yeah, number one, where do you get them developed?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, your guests own smartphones.
Yeah.
They're already taking photos at your wedding. You know that they're going to. And so our app, WedPix, is just an easy solution to collect all of those photos from your guests that you already know that they're taking.
Yeah, this way, I mean, you don't have every single person saying, you know, 3 weeks, a month, 2 months, a year later, oh yeah, I've got this great shot from your wedding, when it's something that could have been shared with the whole family and everybody that was there.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a one-stop shop. And if after you've been married, after your wedding, the last thing you want to do is hound your friends and family, or end up with, you know, your grandmother might send you prints that she took on her old camera, and then you have friends that are texting you photos, you have friends that are emailing you photos, or some photos you're just never, ever going to see at all.
Yeah.
And so if you can go into the wedding anticipating that people are taking photos, and then you can give them this one-stop shop for dumping them into an app, which you can then make prints or downloads or whatever else you want to do with your photos. And it also, I think, it encourages people to take more photos at your wedding. Because, you know, some of those candid shots are the best that you get, and they're the most fun or the most special. So they're definitely ones that you want to see down the future.
Yep.
And to be visible for you.
What a great idea. And honestly, doing this, was this the kind of the come about of going to a wedding and, you know, seeing that maybe they didn't have a photographer and everybody's taking pictures and it just got mumble jumbled?
You would think, because it is one of those no-brainer. I think all the time, like, why didn't I think of this idea? This is a genius idea. No, so we actually got our start way more broad. So this was pre-Instagram, when this type of app didn't really exist. So we were more of an event photo sharing app. So not just weddings, but all events.
Right.
And then it was based on geolocation. The company was called Deja Me at that time. And it didn't quite take off, but where we did see a lot of traction was in weddings. A lot of people were using that app and that idea for weddings. So we saw an end to the market. There aren't a ton of wedding photo sharing apps. We're really one of the only ones that has stood the test of time, and we're also one of the original kind of guys in the space. And yeah, it's a great idea, and we took off. You know, we went super niche and just went into weddings, and it's been great so far.
Well, it's funny because there was an article published. It was really talking about this particular subject, and you know how somebody could get their photos up and get them shared and the whole bit. And the crazy thing is, I think only out of that list of 10, only two were still. And you guys, I looked at your website. And I was reading some of the comments. I read the story on Recode. There's a great story about, you know, how you guys had to stage a fake wedding to kind of make it to make it happen. Obviously, yeah. You do that for marketing, you know, to make it happen. But you have stood the test of time as being really the go-to for this. Now, the other nice thing about it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the service in general for those people to go out, use their smartphones, and upload is basically free.
It's totally free.
So the bride and groom don't have to worry about having to shell out a couple $100 right away. They obviously can let their guests know, hey, use the app and take the pictures.
Yeah, exactly. It's free. We do have some paid upgrades that you can opt for, but just to use the app to collect your guests' photos, totally free.
That is so cool.
Which is huge, yeah. Because it's a big day and people are already spending a lot of money on their wedding, and we don't want to.
Right.
This is a service that we really want to provide and to give to people.
Now, how are like photographers? Because I know, and I do photography, and I've done this. And sometimes they can be kind of grumpy. how are they reacting to it? Are they realizing? Listen, this is really a part of what the bride and groom would like to be able to have. Is that kind of the best way for them to explain it to somebody maybe that they've hired to be the actual photographer?
I think more often than not, if we get grumpy photographers, they're just unsure of what we're doing. So we are not a replacement for a professional photographer for your wedding. I mean,
right.
if you want us to be that, then you can. But we don't market ourselves as we're your only photography.
Right.
For the wedding. No, this is just an addition. This is just an extra service for the bride and groom to just collect all those photos that, you know, people are taking anyway. And we actually encourage, we have tons of photographers who actually upload their photos to the app.
Oh, what a great idea.
And yeah. And it's, you know, it's good promotion for them too. And they have their own profile and they can link back to their, you know, add comments and say who they are, where people can go to, you know, to their website, or if they want to buy prints directly from the photographers.
So what the bride and groom do then is they let their guests know, hey, give them a card or something that says, go, you know, get the app at WedPick. You can install it on your Android or iOS device, and then just, you know, take a picture and it will upload through the app and be on a site that everybody will have the address to and can go look at it.
Right. Yeah. So super easy to create your account. The bride and groom just sign up, and then they'll have, we call it a wedding ID. So it's just a little code that that they can give out. Some people print cards. We offer kind of like little business size cards that you can order through the app, or you can make your own. And then a lot of people will have, you know, signs at their wedding that has their Instagram hashtag, and then they'll have their WedPix information. So you really you want to put it in your guest's face that this is what we're using and here's how to access it. And then all they have to do is just download and just add their photos. It's super, super easy. And it's also accessible just through the web too. So iPhone, Android, and then just webpix.com.
Great stuff. Great idea. And, you know, we're entering the wedding season, and this is, you know, why Lisa reached out to us. Continued success to you. Christina, thanks for talking to us and telling us a little bit about what WedPix is all about. You know, I don't plan on doing it again, but, you know, if I did, I'd be contacting you.
Thanks so much. I'm getting married in October, and I will definitely be using WedPix at my own wedding.
Oh, that's awesome, and congratulations to you. Thanks
Thank
again.
You. Thanks for having me.
So, you think you'll get married again?
What?
That's not a question you ask a man who has a new child.
Yeah, I was going to say, not in any plans.
So when your child gets married, the technology may still be as where it is now, and your friends and family could use this.
Could be. I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, I mean, this is a really good idea, but I could definitely see some pranksters during the reception who might take some pictures that may not want to be seen by the rest of the
that
guests.
That might be the best.
If you know what I mean.
That might
wink,
be
wink.
The best part of this.
Oh, yeah. Throw them up on a big screen TV. And you're like, well, next picture. I'm like, oh, my God.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about the Technology Council here in Arizona, which, you know, everybody should be doing this, and some of the cool things they're doing in a collaboration with Adobe. We'll be back with more Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andy Taylor.
I'm Justin Lemme. We'll be right back.
Now, back to Tech Talk Radio.
And we're back with Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andy Taylor.
I'm Justin Lemme. You can find us on the web on Facebook at facebook.com/techtalkers.
Or on our website at techtalkradio.com. Check out segments from our Fox 11 videos there. And even some how-to videos that we're starting to do more and more of those. And Justin said he's going to help with those. Right, Justin?
Sure, totally. Actually, you know, I've actually been making how-to videos for my work, trying to train some other people, and it's easier just to make a video of and have them watch my screen than having to try to explain it to each person, you know?
You know what? Companies should really look into this, because the technology is there, and more than likely, they have somebody in the office that is quite familiar with working with, you know, it could be an iPhone, an Android. You don't have to go out and buy these big, you know, computer equipment setups to create a video and use that for training. So that way everybody sees it the same. You don't have to have that person walk them through each and every time. So that's actually a great idea.
Absolutely. I use actually a Zoom meeting. So it's like a GoToMeeting, but it's called Zoom. And then I just launch up a Zoom meeting with myself, and I just click the record button, and then I share my screen to myself, and then I just, you know, record that, and then it makes a great video.
That's a good idea. Well, speaking of training, the Arizona Technology and Education Association and Adobe are getting together to do a contest to help classroom teachers. The idea of a company like Adobe getting behind creatively with the Arizona Technology and Education Association, and something that maybe could stretch for our listeners in Indiana and Virginia, this is something that really could go, you know, beyond the states. So we wanted to talk with the council about just how they're doing that. On the line with us is Dr. Christopher Johnson, who's Chair of Public Policy and Advocacy Committee with the Arizona Technology and Education Association. And they're working on a new project, which I think is just fabulous. And it's something that, while our listeners in Indiana and Virginia may not be privy to, because we're talking Arizona here, it is something that could be available in all of these areas because it's part of a larger project. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Johnson.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about AZT and how this is part of kind of a larger group.
We're the Association for Technology and Education. We're part of, we're the state affiliate for the International Society for Technology and Education. And this is an organization with approximately, 15,000 to 20,000 educators from around the world. who are interested in using digital tools to enhance learning.
What have you seen in the classroom, say, in the last couple of years that it's been pretty remarkable in helping students and teachers both start to use technology?
Well, I think with the explosion of smart devices, your smartphone, your tablet, Chromebooks, and then our old friends of our Apple or our PCs, we're now getting tools into the hands of students. That we're getting video production tools that used to cost tens of thousands of dollars into a kindergartner's hands.
Now, with these tools, there's a contest going on now that the students can participate in. How is this working?
The tool we've selected for our contest is something called Adobe Spark. There's three forms of it. There's Post, in which you can create posters, slides, things you can put on Facebook, Twitter, whatever. There's Page that allows you to create what we call a responsive web page. And responsive is simply that when you take it from your laptop to your tablet computer, it looks the same.
Right.
And then Spark Video. And so, you know, here's a video editing tool that you could go up Adobe's line to Adobe Premiere and spend several thousand dollars and become a professional video editor. But we're going to start you out in first grade. One of the biggest changes we've seen in education is that the tools are now becoming inexpensive enough to get into the hands of kids. The tools are becoming easy enough to use to get in the hands of kids. Now, there's certainly still a divide in terms of those who have access to technology and those who do not, but that divide is shrinking.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, is it difficult for the teachers, the educators that are in the classroom, because they have to understand this more than maybe the first grader or second grader? How is the training applying to some of these educators?
Well, for educators, we are focused more on how is it that you're going to change your teaching and the learning experience for your student based on what these tools will let them do. And you may not know exactly everything that the tool will do, but that's okay because you can put it in the hands of your kids and they'll figure out how it actually works for you.
How is the argument handled? We've heard this before, you know, well, kids should be reading and writing, et cetera. Has that kind of changed because our times have changed?
Well, I would argue that when a kid's online researching whatever it is that they want to do, yes, they may be watching YouTube videos to find out how to do it, but they're also researching websites and they're reading websites. So they are reading, it's just the format of that reading is different. Let's say we tell you to go out and instead of writing that paper, I don't want a book report from you, I want a web page. It has to have as much text as you might have as on your book report. And I would argue that if the activity is engaging and fun, that I'm going to write more for that website than I might do for the paper. They also start to learn much more, from my perspective, the relationship between the written word and visual literacy.
Well, Dr. Johnson, what are the benefits of them using these tools as part of a contest?
Well, we see two benefits to the contest. So if I may, the contest is basically we're asking classroom teachers from throughout Arizona, but as you mentioned, this really could be done in any state.
Yeah.
We as an organization want to collect evidence of the really cool things that teachers are doing to use these digital tools in the classroom. To basically inform parents and school boards and administrators and our legislators as to why it's important to put these tools in the hands of kids. Giving them access to a simple to use tool like Adobe Spark, we're hoping to expose. I'm working with a few folks from Adobe who basically would like half or all of the students in the state of Arizona to at least explore the Spark tools through this contest. Whether they do that or not, I don't know, but boy, it would be really great. The teachers know how they're purposefully using these digital tools to enhance learning. And we measure those against something called the ISTE Technology Standards for Students. And so the International Society for Technology in Education has created a set of standards that we base all work against. And so, is the student an empowered learner? Are they a content creator? Are they a good digital citizen? So the teacher knows they're crafting the experience where their students are using these tools to then express themselves in ways that you and I never were allowed to when we went through school. So then the other half of this contest is we want the students to create a story about that. So use one or more of the Spark formats. And I have to say, when I first started thinking about this, it was, well, okay, they'll use this one or this one or this one. And I was talking to an eighth grader who said, well, can I use all of them?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you can.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but we want to hear the stories from the students as to how their teachers are using technology creatively. And then we're looking at, we're awarding four different levels, pre-kindergarten right. to second grade, third to fifth grade, sixth to eighth grade, and ninth to 12th grade. And the winner of each of those categories will receive a one-year subscription to Adobe's Creative Cloud. The classroom teacher will have it to use with his or her students in their classroom. While there will be one winner in each category, I really feel that the winners will be the students who are able to get in there, get their hands dirty as they play and explore Spark, figure out what it can do. And then maybe not for our contest, but sometime after the contest, when the teacher is asked you to do a book report, and you might say, well, teacher, could I do a video instead? Or could I do a web page? Or could I create a poster? We call them infographics.
Yep.
So, you know, we want them exposed to those tools so that as they go through the rest of their school career, they'll have them at their fingertips to use.
Let me tell you, when I was in sixth and seventh grade, I had Mrs. Antonor as my teacher. I would ask her if I could go into the Learning Center and create a tape. I would grab that old woolen sack cassette deck and I would record tapes and make voices and do goofy things. And obviously, it was my future. I ended up in radio.
It was your way of expressing your understanding.
Exactly. And these kids are going to do the same thing.
Going back to a question you asked me earlier in terms of what's different, I think one of the major things is we now do have so many different ways where students can express their understanding outside of a quiz, a written essay. And for those students who that might not be their strength, it gives them their first way to express themselves. And so when I see really successful assignments, so for you, if I was to talk to Mrs. Antonor, I would suggest, okay, so you let him go do a tape. Now when he's done, he has to write a little PR statement for it. But yeah, let's get that writing back in there. But let's let Andy express himself in a way that he's comfortable with first, so that I can first determine, yes, you're understanding the social studies concept, the physics concepts, whatever it is that I'm trying to get across. You may not be able to do that in writing or in a timed half-hour quiz or exam. But you can do it if I give you tools that let you express yourself in other ways.
Now, if our listeners, Doctor, want to find out more information about this project, or if there's other states that want to maybe go into this, or other counties or other school districts, where can they really start off to get this info?
We have a website that we're using to promote the contest. It is http://tinyurl.com/AZTEA-sparking-creativity. So that's tinyurl.com/AZTEA-sparking-creativity. We're doing a contest under a Creative Commons, and so if anyone else is interested in doing it, if they'd like to contact me, my email is on that website.
Very good.
Or our executive director, Kathy Poplin, her email is also there. And we'll be happy to talk to any other states. We're actually, ISTE has 89 affiliates across the country. We're hoping to roll out this contest once we're done with it, with a number of the other ISTE affiliates throughout the country. So if there are people out there in other places that listen to you. I thoroughly encourage them to come look at the contest and set something like this up. One of the things that I'm really, really pleased with, we've selected a number of really interesting judges, and I'm still confirming it, but two people who have agreed to judge for us. One is the Honorable Jay Lawrence, who's the Vice Chair of the House Education Committee, and the Honorable Kimberly Lee, who is the Vice Chair of the Senate Education Committee, have agreed to be judges.
Nice.
We have judges from our three state universities. We have reached out to some of the other organizations. We have judges from the Arizona School Boards Association. And so we're looking at this as a way to educate our judges also in how students are using these tools. And I, quite frankly, am just waiting to get my socks blown off, because I know when we give kids a challenge like this and the great tools that Adobe Spark can give them, that we're going to see some really interesting stories.
There are really some creative minds out there from, you know, like you say, pre-K and up. And I'm actually looking forward to see how this progresses. And I hope you'll keep us posted. And maybe at the end of the contest, we'll have you on. We can talk a little bit about some of the entries you received and, you know, just how well it was handled.
That would be excellent.
Dr. Christopher Johnson, thank you so much for telling us all about it. And again, this is available in other areas. You can check out AZTEA.org for more info. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Coming back, our website of the week. Justin has picked this one out. I really like it.
Yeah, this is actually a really cool software that can be used to explore deep space.
Wow. Okay. And without having to leave your chair.
Yep. You sit right there on your computer.
That's all coming up on Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andy Taylor.
I'm Justin Lemme. We'll be right back.
And now, back to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Justin Lemme.
I'm Andy Taylor, and you can find us on Twitter at Tech Talk Radio, and even Instagram at Tech Talk Radio. Now, you came up with a website of the week that I like.
Yeah, I found this last night. I was just browsing YouTube, and I was watching a video, and there was a segment inside this video that kind of showed this space simulation, spaceengine.org. So it's just like it sounds, spaceengine.org. It's a universe simulator, and it's totally free. Now, there are ones you can actually buy that are paid, and I almost did. I almost bought one through Steam because it looked really good, but this is free. Now, the only downside to it, though, is base software is 1 gigabyte. So that's
wow.
It's a pretty big. That's nothing, though. Once you get the base software, then you need to get HD pack, Solar System HD, which is 16.5 gigabytes. Then if you want the Solar System Ultra, which gives you like super ultra realistic detailed textures, that's another 29 gigabytes on top of the first 16 gigabytes. So you're looking at about 50 gigabytes total to download this program. They do offer the download via BitTorrent, and it's free. You can click on the torrent file, so you can actually grab bits and pieces of the file from multiple places, and it makes the download a lot faster.
Now, what is it? What does it simulate, though?
It's just like if you're flying around space. You're not in a rocket or anything like that. It's not like Kerbal Space Program. It's just literally a space simulator. You can just float through space, and you can zoom on up to the moon, and you can view the moon from all the angles. You can zoom off towards Andromeda and go visit the Andromeda Galaxy. You can visit all the planets in the solar system and get up close and personal with them. It's just a space simulator. Really cool.
Is it based on science where, I mean, basically you're looking at the moon?
Absolutely.
From, you know, you would
real
be
real pictures.
Real pictures. And of course, yeah. Then going beyond that.
It definitely is a really cool program. And especially if you just go and check out some of the pictures that this thing, they have pictures from the software. You can just see awesome stuff, like pictures of being on Solaris and being able to basically be on the surface of Solaris and looking out and get to see all the planets and the solar system from there.
Now, where can our listeners find this?
Again, it's for free. You can get it at spaceengine.org. And it's a big file to download, but it's well worth it.
Also, next week, we're going to be talking with a company that makes a software that is considered one of the finest for, well, hacking into your own passwords. There comes that time where you forget. So we're going to be talking about that. So if you need to get into a password, they'll be the company you want to look for as far as their software. Have yourselves a great week. I'm Andy Taylor.
I'm Justin Lemme. We'll see you next time.